Now, the voices of Bronco Athletics, Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
It doesn't get any better than winning a national championship. Boise State claims an individual title. Allie Ostrander wins the 3,000-meter steeplechase. It is her first national championship. Boise State is the school's 10th individual national championship. You'll hear from Allie Ostrander in about 10 to 15 minutes.
That was, as usual, very impressive by Allie Ostrander. And we've had Corey Immels on, the track and field coach for Boise State. We've had him on this show quite a few times. And he's mentioned what makes her special. And it hasn't been, you know, the smoothest ride up. And she's had adversity at her time, battling back through injuries. But you knew she was a contender in two events this weekend, and she ended up finishing first in the steeplechase, and then less than 2 hours later, finished another race, the 5K, fourth. I mean, that's pretty ridiculous. Talk about a weekend, and I can't wait to hear how she was able to manage that situation.
Little more than an hour from the end of one race to the start of the next race, and the 15 points that she got for finishing first and fourth put her in 13th place, or put Boise State in 13th place for the weekend.
I mean, that's pretty good for an individual. It's a lot, like, similar to was Emma Bates a few years ago, two events, first and a fourth place finish. You've seen quite a bit of Boise State. I mean, you know, over your time, about a decade worth. Where does this rank in terms of impressive things that you've seen Boise State athletes be able to accomplish?
Right there at the top. I mean, the other ones I'm racking up my brains, what Kellen Moore was able to do, you know, on the football field, 50 wins. But again, that's a team sport. He also was helped out by a number of other good players. And then Kurt Felix winning the decathlon championship and then going on to compete in the Olympics later that same summer. For me, in my 10 years that I've been here, those were the three that come to mind. If you say who accomplished the most at Boise State athletically, to me it would be those three. I'm sure maybe other people might have favorites that they like. Hard to compare team sports with individual sports because how much credit do you give other people that help you around the said athlete that you're talking about? But in this one, nobody's helping Allie Ostrander go over the steeple. Nobody's helping her get out of the water pit, and nobody's running the 8,000 meters that she ran on Saturday. If it was me and I won the 3,000-meter steeplechase, I probably would have headed for the nearest bar and said, let's celebrate, and who cares about the 5,000?
Yeah, it's over. I don't even know how old she is. She might not be 21.
Well, no, she might not.
But it's over. Yeah. You know, I get it. It's over. Why would I try to run after I just became a national champion? There's no topping that moment. So, yeah, to win a title and then decide, less than 2 hours later, let's compete in another long race. It takes a special athlete to do it, and, you know, from all indications, from, you know, we get to be around a lot of these programs, so we get to hear stories not only from the coaches, but from other athletes on campus who talk about Allie. It's like these are Division I high-caliber athletes in their own sport, and they are in awe of what, again, I don't know if you saw the broadcast on TV, but you've seen her run before, I've seen her run before, and she just doesn't fit the profile of somebody who looks like a dynamic athlete. Just really small, you know. It's a long distance race, so you know you're not going to have like the muscular definition of, you know, some of the other track and field athletes. But to think that she is the queen of athletics, basically, right now at Boise State, it's almost striking. It's hard to believe.
Well, and I would have loved to have seen what she could have done with the 5,000 if it had taken place on another day. Now, Missouri's Carissa Schweizer won that race, the race she came in fourth in. And she won by a pretty good margin. She also was the cross-country champ and the indoor champ at 5,000, so she's very accomplished. I don't know if I could go out based on what I saw and say that if she were fresh, she could have run her down. Maybe yes, maybe no. I would have liked to have seen it. But there were two other girls that passed her to come in, so she was fourth instead of second, that passed her right at the end. I guarantee, she would have been second minimum if she would have run on another day.
I mean, the guarantee.
How
could you disagree with that? Because you just nobody else doubled up. Was she the second athlete ever to double up in those two events? So, yeah, of course. If you just ran the 3,000 steeple, you're going to feel it a little bit. You would have to think. I mean, again, I feel it if I ran across the street to go pick up something from Albertson or something. So, yeah. You know, I, who am I to judge what
no,
these high
but I mean, I'd like to think that, that as much of a kick as she showed in the steeplechase,
yeah,
turning it on at the end, she would not have been passed by those other two, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think she would have had at least second, and I would have loved to have seen it. And maybe we set up a great run with this Carissa Schweizer next year, because this girl was only a junior, so you don't expect people to go out early in cross country and track and field. So who knows? We may have a big race next year for the cross country championship, which Ostrander, by the way, did not participate in. She was hurt last year in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Brenna Peliquin, another great distance runner, came in sixth for Boise State in that meet.
Now you just got to kind of connect the dots of like what exactly is it here that is attracting long-distance runners, developing long-distance runners. You mentioned Peliquin, Emma Bates, now Allie Ostrander certainly joining that list or being atop the list, however you want to rank it. That's now a reputation, and you know, this is something that I'm sure Corey Immels is excited about, just having that line of, you know, fantastic athletes who are not only, you know, doing it in the Mountain West, but going to the next level, going to national stages and producing.
I think Corey Immels deserves a lot of credit, he and his assistants, for finding the talent, convincing them to come here, coaching them, improving them. I also think that Boise's climate is pretty good. I've heard that, and I don't run. If you ever see me running, you'll know something's chasing me because I'm not a runner. But I've heard that there's enough altitude here, but not too much. The weather is good for long-distance runners, that this is a very good spot for it.
I mean, you know, Allie's from Alaska. I feel like, you know, Alaska, to be outside running, it's pretty cold there. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I think, you know, we brought up before how, you know, some of the meets that they have in Texas and how you have to deal with that humidity and the heat there and how that compares to running in Boise. And there is somewhat of a difference. But correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't matter. It doesn't seem to matter the location of these events for a lot of these Boise State distance runners. They seemingly are finishing near the top of the field no matter where they put it.
Chris, this just in, they're good.
Yeah, no matter where they put it, they're pretty good. So it got me to thinking, like, I did the same exercise you did. I don't really have the, you know, grand background of being able to see first person a lot of these Boise State accomplishments. But the more I delved into, like, okay, what are some of the bigger individual achievements that a Boise State athlete has been able to come up with, the more I started to understand the perspective and the reality of a lot of the people who are upset about the wrestling program being taken away. Because the more you do your homework, the more you take a look, a lot of the greatest individual accomplishments for Boise State athletes have come from wrestling. Whether you look at Charles Burton, you look at Kurt White, you look at Ben Cherington, like these are Olympians, national champions. And you go to think, well, there isn't that many with Boise State. There isn't that many individual accomplishments that rank around the area where Allie was able to do over the weekend. And when a good handful of them are from a sport that's not going to be continued from here on out, you start to sense the disappointment and you understand it a little bit more. So if anything, Allie's run made me appreciate the wrestling program just that much more and sympathize a little bit more with them, the people who are a part of that program over the years, and understand their disappointment for it not being there anymore.
Well, I think there is just something different about winning as an individual, because you don't get help from anybody else. Like in football, if your left tackle misses a block, maybe the fullback can pick him up and chip and save your quarterback from getting sacked. Nobody gives you help. It's all you. I'm sure teammates can spur you on in your workouts and can be there, give you support. But to me, I was doing a show one time in Massachusetts, and we asked people, if you could win anything in the world of sports, what you would want to win.
Oh.
And it's amazing. 90% of our callers, and we probably fielded about 20 callers, all wanted to win something individual. They did not want to win a team. It was like, you know, coming down 18, having the crowd cheer for you for winning the Masters, winning the heavyweight championship, being the fastest, you know, man winning the 100-meter dash. Virtually every single person that we took a call from that day wanted to win something individual, not something as a team.
Well, let's open up that. That's fun. 208-424-9300, the commercial tire text line. What would be the one event for me? Certainly be, I want to be called the fastest man. So 100-meter, just straight yard, 100-meter dash. I'll take that one. That would be easy choice. But you know, heavyweight boxer, I guess at one point, like, if you could,
that was a big deal.
Heavyweight boxer, the heavyweight champion, that's something else too. And now being the 3,000 steeplechase for Ali Ostrander, that ranks up there for the Boise State Accomplishments.
Well, we're going to find out a little bit more about Ali and how she was able to get it done. Don't forget, the extreme competitive kayaking is coming this Thursday through Saturday to the North Fork of the Payette River. The best big water paddlers will be there, and you can meet them at the Egyptian Theater in downtown Boise on Thursday night. Details are available at KTIK.com, and it's all brought to you by Toyota, one of the top sponsors of the North Fork. Up next, we'll talk to Ali. She'll tell us why she thought she'd be good at the 3,000-meter steeplechase. It was only the fourth time she'd ever run it competitively. Next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Boise State with a national champion on Saturday, Ali Ostrander, wins the 300-meter steeplechase. She is the seventh track and field athlete, third woman, 10th individual overall at Boise State to get it done. Very impressive for Ali Ostrander. She's going to be here several more years.
It's fun to watch when you have a athlete that you can root for on the national stage like that with the Boise State logo on her, and you can yell and scream from home. I'm sure it was a lot more exhausting, though, for somebody who was actually doing it.
We welcome Ali Ostrander here to Idaho Sports Talk. Ali, why did you decide to run the steeplechase? You've only now done it four times in your career, and why do you think you are good at it?
Well, I decided to try the steeplechase, you know, after a fall and winter of injuries. I just wanted to try something new and that I could get really excited about. And I think that for me, it was just a combination of the fun and enjoyment that I found in the steeplechase and also the mix of athleticism and speed and endurance that was required to have success in the event.
You mentioned the fun and enjoyment. Now, of course, winning is fun and enjoyable, but like, what else besides you being good at it is fun and enjoyable?
Well, it's just a really different event than anything I've ever done before. The steeples and the water jump kind of distract me from just the running aspect, so that's nice to have something to focus on other than just keeping the pace. You know, it's like keeping the pace until the next barrier and the next barrier, and it really breaks it up.
We're visiting with Ali Ostrander, Boise State track and field champ in the 3,000-meter steeplechase here on Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris. Ali, you're not the tallest person out there. Was it difficult when you first started with the barriers in the water? Because that, to me, is very different than trying to run a long distance.
I didn't have a lot of problems with the normal barriers because I did some hurdling in middle school and high school, so that technique is really similar. But for the water jump, I'm not sure if it was because of my height. I really don't think it was. I just, in the beginning, I just was not good at it at all. And still, when I do it outside of a race, I look pretty horrendous. But for some reason, in a race atmosphere, I'm able to get over it a lot better.
Now, like Bob mentioned, maybe you're not the biggest person out there, but like, what is it about you? This, you know, young person from Alaska who came to Boise State, like, it doesn't necessarily pop out as, you know, the greatest athlete on campus, but there's something about you. Coach Immel said toughness. What do you think it is about yourself that allowed you to capture a national championship?
You know, I think that a lot of distance runners have a lot of the same qualities, and all of us have a pretty high pain tolerance and the ability to mentally push through when we start to get tired. And I think that in big races, I'm able to channel those qualities and get through them.
All right, let's talk about the winning race in the 3,000-meter steeplechase. It was you and the runner from New Hampshire, Eleanor Purrier, not sure how she pronounces it. She took a bit of a lead over you with 300 meters to go. What was your thoughts, and how were you able to beat her?
Coach Emmels had told me that would likely happen, and just to focus on matching her move and then trying to get momentum going off of the last water jump into the final straight stretch. So that was what I tried to do on the back stretch, was just get into a good position going into the water jump, and then I was able to get over it smoothly and maintain my momentum.
At what point in the race, with how much left to go, were you confident that this was yours?
Once I got over the water jump, I thought that I could probably win it, but I didn't know how close she was behind me or how close anyone else was, because I just never look back in races because I'm so afraid that if I look back, then someone will pass me. So I didn't actually know, and I was just running with everything I could to make sure no one passed me.
We're visiting with Allie Ostrander, Boise State track and field champ in the 3,000-meter steeplechase, also came in fourth in the 5,000 meters. How did you run another race longer than the steeplechase with, what, about an hour to rest between the two races?
Yeah, it was about 75 minutes between the races. But I just finished the steeplechase and did a tiny bit of a cool down and then put my feet up and tried to rest and do as short of a warm-up as possible for the 5K. And I mean, a big part of it for me was just not really thinking about what I was about to do. I didn't overanalyze how difficult it would be to run a 5K after already having run a steeplechase. I just kind of entered the race and ran it like it was my first race of the day.
I've tried to put myself in your position, right? Like, you just ran a 3,000-meter steeplechase to win a national championship. What's running through my mind is, I'm done. Like, you know what? It's over. I just won a national championship. Why am I going to run another 5,000 meters in a race? Like, I just got to the top of my craft. I'm going to enjoy the moment. Was there any thought to that for you?
You know, I actually did think that for a second after I finished. I was like, you know, I think this is enough. You know, I can just be done now. But then I, like, walked off the track, and coach was like, all right, one down, one to go. And I was like, well, I guess, you know, we're doing the next one too.
Now, you were the only person that ran in both of those races. How much better do you think you could have done if you had run the 5K, say they had the race Sunday instead of Saturday?
I don't know. There's really no telling. But I know that I could have run faster had I not already done the steeplechase. But I don't know how much.
I mean, how are they organized in terms of, like, you know, you're somebody who wanted to win both? They could have moved it to Sunday, or what was it about the event that they couldn't have it on Sunday? Do you know the answer to that?
The meet didn't go to Sunday.
The meet didn't go to Sunday? Okay.
Right. This was hypothetical, meaning one other day.
Because it was multiple days, though, mm-hmm. Correct? So why couldn't they have still split those two events? They didn't have every event the same day.
Well, so most of all of the finals except the 10,000 were on Saturday. So on the other day of the meet, there was a steeplechase prelim. So I would have had like two races in the same day, regardless of what day the 5K was on.
Then I heard a story, and I don't know if this is true or not, that on Sunday you had to go and work your job. So it's no rest for the weary.
Yeah. We got back from Eugene at like 10 a.m. and then I had a shift at 11:30. So,
nice. So, what's next for you in terms of? I know you've already captured all these heights early on in your career. We've profiled you, it seems like, for a couple of years now, and the ability that you have to run. When you've already won a championship and you finished fourth in a different event that was already on the same day, how do you keep yourself goal oriented?
You know, I actually think that performing well is one of the biggest motivators because it feels really good, and I want to be able to have that feeling again in future competitions.
So what else do you think you can win here? Can we see you win the cross-country championship? I know you ran in the Olympic qualifier over the summer. Is that still out last summer? Is that still out there in the future for you?
You know, I hope to be able to run in another Olympic trials in the future, to run this cross country season and perform with the entire Boise State team. The future is really open, and I'm looking forward to getting back to training and starting to work towards other goals.
And that was Allie Ostrander on her championship win in the 3,000 meters, fourth place finish in the 5K. She will try to do what Gabe Wallen is the only Boise State athlete to have done. He won an NCAA event in the javelin both in 2004 and 2005. So try to become the second individual to win two.
From Sweden, right? I believe. Original.
Gabe Wallen?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. I could be wrong. I've not looked this up before, but yeah, to be able to reach the you know, type of level that Allie's at this early, I mean, that's got a lot of time to rack up some more accolades. So
she certainly does. And with Pelequin, if they're both healthy, could Boise State win a team national championship in cross country?
Could they? That's kind of hard to do. Can they?
I think they can.
Wow. I don't know actually how
they're all healthy.
If they can do it, that'd be very entertaining.
Enjoy Idaho's only authentic Greek gyro, made with all-natural, traditionally marinated, hand-stacked meats, as well as fresh local ingredients. It's at Meraki Greek Street Food. It's located in Bodo on 8th between Front and Myrtle. Fish, we got an update coming up. What's in it?
Well, LeBron James is a big fan of the new Olympic sport, 3-on-3 basketball. Just don't expect to see him on the court unless there's a couple guys whose names are MJ or paired alongside him. Plus, the New England Patriots received their Super Bowl rings, and they took several shots at the Atlanta Falcons. That's coming up next in the sports update on Idaho Sports Talk. And we'll start the ticket sports update with some LeBron James news. And no, it doesn't have to do with Game 5 of the NBA Finals tonight. Instead, James was talking about the newest Olympic sport, 3-on-3 basketball. James said, quote, "I think it's great for basketball, for us to be able to add another category to the Olympics. However, just don't expect James to be out on the floor." James said, quote, "I'm not very good in this 3-on-3 thing. I'm more of a 5-on-5 guy. I stay out of the 1-on-1 matchups during practices, the 2-on-2s, and the 3-on-3s. However, LeBron still gave his own dream team if he did ever want to compete. He told the Associated Press that his two other teammates would be Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson.
Not bad choices, but this is why LeBron James is soft, because he doesn't get into the one-on-one games at practice. He's soft. Kobe Bryant, he would get into all the one-on-one games, and he'd beat everybody one-on-one. Just talk to him about it. He'll tell you how he beat everybody on the Lakers in one-on-one. That's why LeBron's soft. See, I just played the role of your typical LeBron hater. It was fun. Now I see why people do that. It was fun for like 30 seconds. I mean,
I dare you to do it to his face.
I mean, enough people do. That one Cleveland fan, didn't he do that in Cleveland for Game 3 of the Boston series? And he's like, "Well, what do you?" LeBron clapped back. "Well, what do you do?" He's like, "I'm the star of my D3 basketball team." So yeah, people aren't afraid to do it to LeBron James's face. And you know why? Because he's soft.
I mean, well, if you ask J.R. Smith, J.R. Smith even said when asked about it that Kyrie Irving's probably the best one-on-one player on the team. So his own teammates don't even think he's the best one-on-one player.
You know what? Basketball's still basketball. If it's 5-on-5 or 1-on-1, I think you're in good shape if you take LeBron. But I do agree. Kyrie got them handles that are, you know, pretty good for one-on-one. Kyrie just wishes the NBA was one-on-one. No teammates? That is great for him. Don't got to pass the ball to nobody. Doesn't even average like any assists per game anyway.
Russell Westbrook would probably like a one-on-one as well.
Didn't Russell want to clap back? Hey, at least I average some assists. Kyrie Irving, was his career high in assists, like 4 per game as a point guard? That's not good enough.
And if you're curious, they've announced the rules for 3-on-3 Olympics. They're going to be playing by 2s and 1s, 12-second shot clock, 10-minute game clock.
I don't like 2s and 1s. I think it gives too much weight to a 3-point shot.
If Steph Curry's going to come out here and just stay behind the arc and do nothing else, you're right. Like, 2s and 1s is unfair on the playground. Like, that one good shooter all of a sudden controls the game at a level that's really imbalanced. Mm-hmm. 2s and 3s gives you at least a little bit more
balance. I think they should play 2s and 3s and bump the what you need to win by. You know, up the score. Yeah.
All ones.
I don't have a problem with that either.
All ones. Get to the basket. This is like street ball. Get to the rim.
Well, speaking of real basketball, not street basketball, Chris Lewis, Game 5 of the NBA Finals is tonight. And while the Cavaliers presented a 16-0 postseason run by the Warriors with a Game 4 win, Tyronn Lue's Game 4 performance featured 7 technical fouls. Is exactly what the Cavaliers should be doing this whole time. Tyronn Lue said, quote, "I thought the first two games we were being too nice. First game, 3 games, we were helping guys off the floor, smiling, talking to guys. Yeah, I didn't like that." So there you go. Expect a bunch of technical fouls for the rest of this series.
Well, I was going to say before that Chris gets into it, if they're going to give technicals tonight, they need to make sure they know who they're against. I thought the league on one side was either very shoddy with their bookkeeping as far as who the technical fouls were on, or flat out cheated and flipped it one way when it should have been the other.
I think it's more likely the second one. Like, it all seemed like Draymond Green got that tech. It was in the book, it's a Draymond Green tech, and then, like, the ref forgot that he already gave him a tech when he gave him the second one. It's like, all right, we can't toss him for this. So let's just say the first one was on Steve Kerr. Seven technicals in the game. It's funny. The people complain that the Warriors, what separates the 96 Bulls and the 80s Lakers and Celtics from the Warriors is that the physicality in the game was different back then. But as soon as the game gets physical now, everybody's like, oh, eject everybody. Throw them out. It's like, well, what do you want? Do you want the game to be more physical like it was back then? Or do you want people thrown out for being physical? Like, you know, the flagrant fouls and, you know, Zaza Pachulia doing Zaza Pachulia thing. So do you want the physicality or do you not want the physicality? I'm trying to figure you guys out. I think what's more important for Cleveland, though, is to slow the pace. They did, as odd as it sounds, like 49 points in the first quarter, 86 points at halftime. This was actually one of the slower games in the series. It was a lot of free throws and three-pointers that made the point total go up more than it was the number of possessions in the game. So if they're able to slow it up, can we get to game six? And if we get to game six, are we getting a game seven? Pretty important game tonight.
I think the pressure's on Golden State tonight. Because Cleveland, when you're down 3-0, I think you're kind of, yeah, whatever. We're sort of, you know, you get a win, you're a little bit on house money. Golden State loses the game tonight at home. You got to stare a trip back across the country to Ohio, play them there. And then if you come back to a game seven, tell you what, that neck, the collar that was maybe, say, 18 inches is going to feel like it's 15 inches putting that dress shirt on.
Yeah, playing skirt for sure, but you mentioned the pressure. It doesn't really get more pressure than if you lose a series. I mean, that's, Cleveland's in a bad spot too, but if Warriors lose two in a row after last year, that's fun.
Speaking of pressure, a lot of pressure on the Warriors, not like you guys talked about, and one Warriors fan, that is because all three times in the NBA Finals, the team has been down 3-0 and forced a Game 5. That team has also forced a Game 6. One fan is under pressure because he paid $133,000 for two floor-side seats for Game 5 of the NBA Finals to watch the Golden State Warriors win. Obviously, if they lose, he just paid $133,000 for nothing. NBA record for most expensive tickets ever sold, and that included $17,000 in fees.
I assume that that purchase came after Game 4.
Yes.
Because I don't know that I would have risked that much expecting a Game 5.
That's that Bob Beeler money. I have no idea what that kind of money is.
You better be sitting next to Rihanna or something like that for that price.
I think that seat next to Rihanna would be pretty fun. I don't know what that kind of money is like, though. No. I don't know what kind of lifestyle it would be for me to be able to spend.
What
that
about
much
$90,000? There's a pair that went for $90,000. Is that more than Chris Lewis? What about $82,000?
That ticket is literally worth more than me. Like, that ticket could sit right here, and it would be worth more than what my entire...
We have a chair open here, and if somebody wants to pay $66,000, they could sit next to us.
As we'll split that. That's fine. You can get half
split it three ways. We'll each get $22,000.
I'm in.
It's not a bad deal. Now, the Warriors and Cavs are competing for their NBA title. New England Patriots received their Super Bowl rings over the weekend following their win over the Falcons in Super Bowl 51. And the Patriots did so much to make fun of the poor Falcons. The rings contain 283 diamonds. Of course, that would be the score. The Falcons led by 28-3 when the Patriots took over. But that was not all. During the ceremony, to prevent anyone from opening their box early, Robert Kraft had all of the rings locked in an individual lockbox for each person in attendance. And then he gave out the combination. The combination, 8-3-1. That's how much time was left in the third quarter when the Patriots received the kickoff after the Falcons' final touchdown of the game.
Oh, man. The level of pettiness is great. Although, is it just the way we want to interpret it as pettiness, or is it like a celebration on their comeback ability? Like, you could take it the other way.
They were celebrating their comeback because their official press release said the rings have more than 280 diamonds. I don't know who counted them. So the Patriots weren't bragging that it had 283. They just said more than 280.
Well, they said more than 283, but come on. How do you come up with 283? Why would you have
They've admitted it was a nod to the score, but it's a comeback nod.
Yeah, I mean, a nod to the score. They should celebrate the fact that they came from behind. We're interpreting it as
the ring also says greatest comeback ever and unequivocally the sweetest, of course, to what Robert Kraft said after the game when asked about the Super Bowl.
So Robert Kraft is the one who comes up with the sayings that are enshrined forever?
Yep.
All right.
Well, he's the one paying for it, I guess. So if that's the case, he can decide what's on. Unless if the league gives you money for it, I don't think that's true. But if they did, he still would be the guy the league would be giving the money to. So ultimately, he's paying for it.
And then we'll end with some NBA news. Gordon Hayward is set to become a free agent July 1st when the next league year begins, and he set social media abuzz as there have been rumors he's going to look to rejoin his former college coach Brad Stevens with the Boston Celtics. And Hayward's wife posted a picture on Instagram with Hayward's two-year-old daughter. Only problem, the daughter is wearing a shirt that said Go Green with a shamrock on it. And of course, Twitter now believes Gordon Hayward heading to the Boston Celtics.
Could be a great ploy that by making everybody think that the Celtics are the leader in the clubhouse, maybe you can juice the money up from one of the other teams, no?
The problem is in the NBA that there's a max salary. Like, I would normally agree that, like, yeah, that's something you would do to help get more money from somewhere else, but the problem is they put a cap on it. So he's going to get the max from at least two teams, the Jazz and the Celtics, probably the Heat too. So, you know, what else can you get besides the max? Like, can you get, you know, maybe a more of a parade when you decide to stay with Utah? Because didn't they have a billboard already that said Stayward?
Yeah.
Like, you know, instead of Hayward, Stayward. So maybe it makes himself look more like a hero if even I have my daughter up in here wearing a green shirt, but I still turn that down to stay with you fine folks of Utah and Salt Lake. It makes him sound like more of a conquering hero. That's all
I think he's going to Boston, don't you?
You know what? Miami. I'm going to guess Miami. A little dark horse there. Pat Riley, South Beach. He does have a family, though, right? Like, you mentioned daughter. Yeah. So, like, if he was single, I'd say Miami would have even more of a leg up. But he's more of a family man. But I wouldn't rule out Miami.
Your dad won $4,000 to upgrade his favorite spot at home. Where would it be? Would he get a huge TV? Biggest grill ever? Upgrade all his lawn care equipment? Tell us at KTIK.com and win $4,000 for your top pop. It's all brought to you by Larry Miller Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram. Go to KTIK.com now. Coming up on Quick Hits, Chris will talk about LeBron James. Can he be the finals MVP even if the Cavs lose? And I'll talk about what was the most impressive thing I saw over the weekend in sports. That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Time now for Quick Hits, where Chris and I tackle four topics in rapid-fire fashion. Let's go.
Topic number one.
All right, Chris, at what point should an event name be after a person?
I think when you win it for the 10th time. And as Rafael Nadal winning the French Open. He's won this thing 10 times, like 15 majors in his career. He won it for the third time without dropping a set this time. I feel like this is now the Rafael Nadal Open. He's so dominant on clay. He's been doing this for such a long period of time. Again, there's only one of these each year. You've won 10 of them. I'm going to now call it the Rafael Nadal Open from now on.
And if nothing else, they should follow in the footsteps of the Vince Lombardi Trophy for the NFL or the Larry O'Brien Trophy. And on the men's side, the winner of the French Open should get the Rafael Nadal Trophy.
Yeah, and the Bill Russell Award for Finals MVP. He won 11 titles. He got 10. 10 should be the number.
Topic number two.
What was the most impressive thing that you saw over the weekend?
Well, it was Aaron Judge's 20th home run of the season for the Yankees. He's become a cult-like figure. His 496-foot bomb to left center field hit just short of the numbers of the retired numbers at Yankee Stadium. It was the longest measured home run since they started keeping distances in 2009. He went on to hit another home run in the game yesterday in the seventh inning. His 21st leads the majors. Two other Yankees that hit better than 60 home runs. Babe Ruth hit 60 in 1927. Roger Maris hit 61 in 61 through the same number of games, were one less home runs, but on the same day they hit 19 and 20 when Judge hit 20 and 21. This is a bona fide superstar.
He can hit the ball a long way. Big dude, powerful, and he's in a rhythm right now. Yankees are in a groove too offensively. Do we expect him to be able to handle everything that comes from being a star player in New York? Because that's the next level. We brought up, was it Matt Harvey, who was the last guy in New York that we tried to turn into like this superhero type character. Him, it was almost literally. And then he kind of fell off a cliff. So will Aaron Judge be able to handle the successes of New York?
I have more confidence in somebody playing for the Pinstripes than playing out in Queens.
Topic number three.
All right, Chris, could LeBron win the finals MVP if Cleveland loses tonight?
I think he could. I just wouldn't be happy with it. I mean, he's been great this series. Don't get me wrong. You know, starting off with the 28-15-8 in game one. After game two, 29-14-11. Yes, a triple-double. 39-31 points this two games in Cleveland. While doing this, while shooting about over 50% and also being pretty confident from three-point range as well. So he's doing it all, and he's been the best player in the series. Finals MVP is meant for the winning team. Let's not get cute with this and try to be like, well, he was the best player on a losing team. No, it's the award given to the team that wins the series. And right now it's Kevin Durant. If the Warriors win it and Steph Curry goes for like 60 in game five, then maybe it goes to Steph Curry. But you're not going to give it to the guy whose team lost in five games. Stop it.
If he gets to seven, maybe a different story. If Golden State would have won in seven, he would have had my vote last year.
Topic number four.
Wouldn't he have had your vote 2 years ago when they lost in six? You were saying that LeBron.
Yeah, LeBron. Yeah.
Serious. Yeah. So you're not on this. It has to come from
team. Definitely not. It doesn't have to come from the winning team. They get the trophy that says team champion. Best player might not be on that team for me.
What is happening tonight in baseball that won't pay off for several years?
It's a Major League Baseball draft. Tonight is the first round. And always questions of whether there is a high school or college player taken. The last 20 years, most people like to take a pitcher with the first pick. There have been 32 college pitchers taken in the first five picks, and there have been 16 high school pitchers, so it's 2-1. And in the war, wins against replacement, college players have scored better in their major league careers, 6.1 to 4.0. First round, huge. Since the wild card era began in 1995, only the Arizona Diamondbacks in 2001 did not have one of their own first round picks. Last year, the Cubs had four. In 2015, Kansas City had five. And the Giants officially had four, but really had five. Kane wasn't active on the World Series roster. So if you want to win, make your first-round picks count.
Okay, it makes a lot of sense. If you pick high in the draft, you need to make sure you get somebody who's a foundational piece. But with baseball, it's just so hard to keep track of it because even if he's a bona fide guy, the odds are he's not going to make an impact for a couple of years on the big league club, save for a couple of exceptions here and there. But like, I'm going to bring up this question for a casual baseball fan. You would call yourself, you're pretty like invested fish, right?
Yeah, I am.
Who was the first pick in the draft last year? Do you know?
No idea.
See, do you know? You remember?
No,
the first
I don't.
Pick? See, like, it's the thing. Like, the first pick in the draft from just last year, nobody remembers because he hasn't had any kind of an impact.
It was looking at Mickey Moniak for the Phillies.
Yeah,
which
Mickey,
you probably knew. Now, the one thing tonight, Hunter Green could be taken. He's a high school pitcher, right-handed pitcher. I would not have thought this was true, Chris. There has never been a high school right-handed pitcher taken first.
Wow.
There have been three lefties, and none of them have done anything.
That's interesting fact. The draft's been around quite a bit.
65.
Stat to be true in 2017. By the way, Mickey Moniak of the Phillies, number one pick last year. In Lakewood, which is their A club, he's hitting 266, 325, 397 with 14 doubles, 4 triples, 2 home runs, 5 stolen bases, caught 4 times.
You're not that happy.
Not really good.
No, that's what I was going to say.
It's not that good. Come on. You need to do a little bit better if you're the number one pick in the draft in your second year. You're here in A ball. You should be putting up some numbers. And that's not the case.
Boise Hawks come into town tomorrow at 2:15. We'll hear from one of the newest players on the Boise Hawks. So 2:15 tomorrow as they get ready to start their season Thursday.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris on 93.1 The Ticket.
Number one picks in the draft and all the other sports, or at least you know a lot of the major ones, like, unless they're hurt, like Ben Simmons. Like Philadelphia had a stretch where they had like the number one pick in every sport. That's how bad this city has been in sports lately. But you know, unless they're hurt, like you would like to think that they can make an impact for your team. But baseball doesn't work that way, so that's why you bring up the stats of like how rare it is for a number one pick to be Hall of Fame good.
Uno,
hey, that's
Ken Griffey Jr. or Ken Griffey Jr. the only number one pick to make it to the Hall of Fame. I think there might be a couple that might have a shot. I think that Chipper Jones will be a lock to get in the Hall of Fame, and I think A-Rod probably, under some people's values, won't get it. Other people will, but those are a couple of the top picks in the draft.
Hall of Fame career. Now, Whether he gets into the Hall of Fame is another discussion. But, yes, he's a Hall of Fame career. But that's the point about baseball. There's so much that has to do with development that still happens between when they're actually drafted and when they're ready to come into the big leagues. Like, you can still mess it up. Like, you can pick the right guy, and your system along the way still messes it up. Generally, with the other sports, like, you're going to have a chance with your big club, the main team, right away, right after you're drafted.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a high school kid, you're probably looking at, what, 4 or 5 years before you make it? And If you're a college pick, couple, 2, 3 maybe?
So that's 2 or 3 years to mess things up. You can go downhill from here. You draft a guy with you believe to be the potential to be a great player, and your system has that much time to mess things up. And, of course, it has to do with the guy, too. I mean, if you pick the guy who doesn't, you know, put in the time or doesn't work, I mean, you can accept some kind of responsibility for it.
And I think in the past, some of the injuries, knee injuries or shoulder injuries, derailed careers. Now, I think with the Tommy John surgery and things like that, it might just delay it a little bit. When we come back, Stanley Cup final last night, we'll give you our observations. Not necessarily the most hockey people, but we've got our thoughts on the Penguins winning. That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. National Hockey League over. Stanley Cup last night presented to the Pittsburgh Penguins in Nashville. First time in that series in the 6 games that the visiting team was able to come out on top. Tonight it's Game 5 in the NBA Championship, so we could have our 2 pro winter sports seasons ending in back-to-back nights. Chris, I find I don't watch much regular season hockey, if any, but when it gets to postseason hockey, I think the play for me really elevates, and I get excited about it because most of the games are close, and I follow it a lot more by far than I do the regular season, and find that, you know, you'll get some compelling series out there. And this past year, other than the championship round, they really had a lot of overtime games and a lot of tight games.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to how much more intense it gets in the playoffs in the regular season, because I will say I've not locked in as much on the regular season to notice the up in intensity, because, you know, college basketball and NBA, limited amount of time of the day. But I decided to tune on in to the Stanley Cup final, and it's the last game, the clinching game, and it seems like a lot of people hopped on board too who weren't usually on board to watch the clinching game, because it was up 28% on the television rating standpoint than the clincher from a year ago when the same team won it. So you can't say it was like, the Pittsburgh, you know, they were looking to see their team hoist the cup for the first time forever. No, I mean, they had won it the year before against San Jose. So I don't know exactly what drew the 28% rise. Could it be that's what Nashville is, the story of the playoffs in the NHL? The event du jour of the spring season has been to get on out to Nashville and watch a hockey game there, because it apparently is different. You got catfish and everything. So maybe that's the reason that people got attracted to it. But 28% is 28%. That's something to be encouraged about.
Last year went 5 games, and I'm looking to see what day of the week, because I think day of the week sometimes matters.
Fair.
And this was a Sunday night, and I think for a lot of people, Sunday evenings people are not out getting ready for the week. I think that is worth a lot. I think the NBA would have had a better rating last night than they would tonight.
Okay, that's fair. Friday night was the worst way to have your season end, and
correct,
the NBA made sure that it didn't end on a Friday night with the way they officiated that game.
I want to correct myself. Last year's series went 6 games.
Okay.
So it went the same.
So it was very comparable. Game 6 each way. I don't know the day of the week that it was concluded on.
They both concluded
on ended on a Sunday.
Wow. Then you got to take that out. It's the same number of games.
Yep.
And the same day of the week.
So what do you think, Mr. Hockey Expert?
I think people were maybe intrigued with Nashville because they certainly were talked about more as a venue for sure than the Sharks in San Jose. Pittsburgh maybe was worth something on a repeat champion.
Mm-hmm.
People would know some of the names before. I think, and this will never happen, and I'm not advocating it would happen, but when I watch hockey, the thing that I have to think most about is individually who has the puck or who's doing what with the puck. Because everybody looks similar with the helmet, and unless you can see the numbers, and they're only on the backs, they're not on the fronts, so you got the crest on the front, it's harder to tell. I think hockey would be a much more enjoyable sport to watch in the old days when they didn't have helmets. You could see people's faces. You could see their hair. And you could know exactly who was who.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I will take you through my viewing exercise, and maybe I can help you understand, and you guys can share your viewing experience for this too. But I was watching the soccer game, the game of the United States against Mexico at the Azteca, and it was a 1-1 draw, good result for the United States team. And while soccer is a much slower game, there probably isn't as many scoring chances as a period of a hockey game. But what you can see is the looks of the players. Everybody looks different. Like, they're not all padded up to where they're all built looking like the same. You can tell the difference between Pulisic versus Dempsey versus Bradley. Like, they don't all look the same. So I went from that. And it was a pretty dramatic end to the game to tuning into, like, the third period of the hockey game, which was kept the intensity up. But that was the biggest, at least striking thing was, wow, like, even though, like, this is very intense and you can almost feel it coming across the TV, the atmosphere in Nashville, all these dudes just look the same. And I can't, it's like, you know, PK Subban, when they had the close up, at least like he looks a little bit different than a lot of the guys. But when you just have the normal game cam and the puck is sliding across from one side to the other, it is very hard to distinguish Sidney Crosby versus whoever else is on Pittsburgh.
Kenny Malkin or whoever.
Because like Crosby's supposed to kind of jump out, but even he didn't jump out as much as Pulisic jumps out when I watch a United States soccer team. So you know, that was one of the things. And when I got to the game, also the color yellow was very striking. I don't, have we ever had a more yellow series?
Well, the Penguins, the Penguins don't wear yellow jerseys or yellow pants, but yellow was one of their main colors, mm-hmm. and it's certainly a trim color for the Penguins. It was very, very bright to watch that game
so
on TV.
When they're in their white, and then Nashville's in their yellow, and the crowd is in their yellow, and I'm like, wow, this is like Oregon on steroids a little bit. The brightness is popping out. It's like if the Lakers and the Warriors played in a series. But I thought the most funny thing about it is everybody has you know their stereotype of what a hockey fan is and what hockey is and what music they play there. So I tuned to it, and the first thing that's jamming out in the Nashville arena is DMX. They're playing a DMX song, and the crowd's going nuts. I'm like, Nashville, known for the country music? And they're blasting some DMX there when I tune into it. So I was like, all right, I'm invested. You hooked me. DMX music is the one playing in Nashville at the Stanley Cup Final. Not what I expected in the least bit.
I was real disappointed in the first period. It looked like Nashville, trailing 3-2 in the series, got the first goal of the game, and then it didn't count because of an early whistle. And the puck was not covered. That should have been a goal. But a lot of times when officials make mistakes, the league is on them. I don't know how the league could have been on the referee that blew the whistle, because they're instructed, if you lose sight of the puck, you blow the whistle. The puck's on the other side of the goalie. There's no way where he was standing he could have seen the puck.
Doesn't matter. It's a conspiracy. Conspiracy. I don't know why. It just felt fun to yell conspiracy. See, that's the thing. When you're not invested in the sport, you can be, like, extremely reckless in your analysis of it. You can be like, oh, there's conspiracy. The NHL, of course, wants back-to-back champions for Pittsburgh. So that's why they did it. I don't
know. No, the NHL, if they were trying to cheat, would have wanted a game set.
Of course. 5-on-3. Now, this, to me, was a turning point in my expert analysis of this hockey game. There was a 5-on-3 for, what was it, like 35 seconds?
32 seconds. But I thought even more than that was there was at least a man advantage for 3.5 minutes for Nashville.
How does a team defend on a 5-on-3 and not give up a goal? Like, that's incredible to me. Somebody's just like, yeah, watching. These guys got 5 guys on the ice. This team has 3 guys on the ice. You stop them. I don't care if it's for 30 seconds, 20 seconds, 15 seconds. I would think that they'd be peppered with shots, and they weren't exactly peppered with shots. So I was impressed with Pittsburgh, their ability to stop somebody.
I thought Nashville waited for the perfect shot. I think sometimes you got to put stuff on net and hope something bounces in.
All right. So, but you mentioned after that was a power play, right? They had like another minute and a half on a power play.
They had 3.5 minutes total of at least a man advantage.
So when you got 4 and the other team got 5, I think that needs to carry over into other sports. instead of a technical foul being one free throw and a ball in basketball, if you're tired of all these guys yelling at, you know, the officials, and like some people want that cut out the game, like they're tired of Draymond Green's antics of every time he gets a foul called on him, he freaks out, and the technical foul is only one free throw. Can we have, instead of a one free throw technical foul, 2-minute power play? If you got a technical foul, you have to sit on the bench for 2 minutes and your team has to play 5-on-4. What would happen if that were to be the case? Would a team go on a 7-0 run, 9-0 run? The Warriors, the way they could score, could it be a 15-0 run in 2 minutes if the other team only has four guys to defend them?
So let's say, how long do you think it would take to get the first basket? 6 seconds? 8 seconds?
Yeah, probably, right? You'd think you'd be able to get a layup. You'd hope, okay, right? Your team
could
get close to the basket.
How long would you think that you could – could you run 20 seconds out of the 24-second shot clock before – you'd either make them shoot or, I mean, the idea would be you'd want to drain the whole shot clock if you were the team with a man down.
Yep. You can take up 20, 21, 22 seconds, but you're still going to get 3 or 4 possessions with a man advantage in basketball. Like, that would completely change the game of technical fouls. You couldn't risk it. You'd put your team at so much of a risk of a 7-0 run against you. I think it would be much harder to defend than score. Like, maybe Steph Curry on 4-on-5, if it was the Warriors, he could pull up from 30 and probably hit a three. But I don't know how a team could defend 5-on-4 in basketball.
I think if we're at all being serious about this, I think 2 minutes would be too long. I think you'd have to make it a minute or maybe a possession or two possessions or something like that. If you were serious about trying to incorporate it into the game, 2 minutes would be a long time.
One final observation from my enjoyment of watching the hockey final and the trophy presentation. The one thing that they do fantastically in this is that they give the trophy at first to the captain instead of to an owner. I love that. Mm-hmm. Like, why is the owner always the one who gets the championship trophy and all these other sports? I get it. He's paying for everything. It's his team. But, like, you know, the player actually went out there and earned a thing. So let's have the captain be the first one to skate around with the cup. Or let's have in the NBA the finals trophy, the Larry O'Brien trophy, go to LeBron or go to Durant or go to Steph Curry. Why does the Bob or whoever the owner is, I was going to say Bob
Gilbert Myers, or Jacob LaCobb, I think.
Yeah, Joe Lacob.
Lacob or whatever, however he pronounces it. I do think in hockey, there are so many great traditions with the Stanley Cup itself. Mm-hmm. I think one of the great things is who does the captain give it to first? That's always an interesting story of who they deem the next person to receive it. And then what would you do with the cup? If you win it, you get it for a day. The cup's been in pools and backyard barbecues. It's been in cars. It's been in all kinds of things.
And those are the appropriate things you're allowed to say on the air.
Right. So think about it. What would you do with the cup? You can take it to the Emmett Cherry Festival. Why not this weekend? It goes from Wednesday through Saturday. Check out the events, concerts, and carnival. Again, all happening at the Emmett City Park, the 82nd Annual Emmett Cherry Festival. Wednesday to Saturday, you can fill the Stanley Cup full of cherries. Coming up next, the latest phenom on the U.S. sports scene is soccer's 18-year-old Christian Pulisic. Help me with it, Chris.
Pulisic, but I also heard it like 18 different ways, so I'm not even 100% sure. Depends on the broadcast.
How is he? How good is he? And can he lead the U.S. to the World Cup? That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Getting closer and closer to another Soccer World Cup. It's going to take place next year in Russia. Joining Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis here on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio, The Ticket, is our soccer expert, Kyle Bond, who's been a good friend of the show from NBC Sports. .com. He is one of their soccer writers. Kyle, thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate the time. Saw the game yesterday against Mexico, 1-1. A couple of weird, fluky goals with it. What was accomplished in that draw yesterday?
Yeah, actually, a lot was accomplished. The U.S. didn't really need a result going into this game because when you look at the grand scheme of qualifying, this wasn't a game that really anybody expected to get anything from in the first place. So when you do the math out, it really wasn't a huge game for the U.S. going in. The bigger one was against Trinidad and Tobago at home a couple days beforehand, because that one you were expected to get points in. And with the U.S. having a tough start to qualifying, they needed to get points where they're expected to. So the 3 points against Trinidad and Tobago was the important part. Any result against Mexico was a bonus. They got a point out of it, which is great. Playing at the Azteca is always so difficult. And so for the U.S. to get a point out of that was really, really big. Paul Carr, he is an ESPN statistician, does some win probabilities, that kind of a thing for the U.S. national team. And I think he put their qualification probabilities now at about 85% with that point. So it was a big point for the U.S.
So somebody that piques his interest for soccer every 4 years with the World Cup, explain to me, for the U.S. to make the draw, what has to happen?
So they have to finish top three in the final round of what's called the hexagonal, which is the last six for CONCACAF, the North American and Central American region in the World Cup qualifying. So there's in the final round, they've already qualified for the hex a few years ago. And in the final round, they need to finish top three of the six. Fourth place can still make it in via a playoff with a member of the Asian Confederation. The finisher is in the Asian Confederation, but it's like, I think maybe third place in Asia will play the fourth place finisher in CONCACAF. So there's a playoff. Number four could still make it, but top three automatically qualify for the World Cup, and the U.S. is expected to be there. Them and Mexico are easily the two best in CONCACAF, so that's where the U.S. needs to finish right now.
Kyle Bond joining us from NBCSports.com talking soccer. So you kind of got to my next question. Mexico is probably going to be the top team from this group?
Yeah, no question about it.
Who does the United States have to be worried about anybody?
I would say Costa Rica right now. The U.S. currently sits in second, but they've got a game up on Costa Rica because Costa Rica, or the rest of the four teams in the hex don't play until tomorrow for their sixth game. So Costa Rica is probably the other difficult team in the hex right now. Trinidad and Tobago, not really a contender. Honduras and Panama are those three probably make the lower three in the hex right now. But Costa Rica is definitely probably the other team that the U.S. would have to worry about.
You mentioned the slow start to the qualifying process, and Jurgen Klinsmann being the one in charge. He was let go. Bruce Arena being back in charge of the program. What has been the noticeable difference between the two coaches, and where does the team sit at this point?
Well, a lot of what we thought Bruce Arena would bring was consistency, because Jurgen Klinsmann was known for just throwing things at a wall until they stuck, and a lot of them didn't stick. And eventually that came back to bite him when he would do this sort of experimentation in meaningful games. And so Bruce Arena is known for his consistency, and what he brings to the table is he's going to call the same players in every time. He's going to put them in a position that they're familiar with and tweak things when they need to be tweaked, but not really on a consistent basis. There's just a base level that the players can expect when they get called into international duty. Now, that wasn't necessarily the case against Mexico, because he changed almost the entire squad. He made seven changes in the team from the one that played just 3 days prior against Trinidad and Tobago, and it was a completely different formation, too. So all of a sudden, everybody went, hold on, Bruce Arena is Klinsmanning. And it turned out after the game, when the media talked to some of the players, that Arena had actually prepared them for this formation and this lineup against Mexico 3 weeks in advance, which is not something that Jurgen Klinsmann was known for doing. So even when he changed things up, he gave the players enough time to prepare and to get ready for, okay, this is the lineup, this is the formation, we've got 3 weeks to prep. So that's what Bruce Arena brings that Jurgen Klinsmann didn't.
Kyle Bond, NBC Sports soccer writer, joining us here on Idaho Sports Talk. Christian Pulisic, he scored a couple of goals against Trinidad and Tobago, so a lot of high expectations going into that Mexico game for him. Did not score, was subbed out late. How good is he right now at the age of 18, supposed to be the next big phenom?
Yeah, well, everybody's talking about Christian Pulisic as the next big phenom. Guys, people think I'm crazy when I say this. I'm not crazy, I promise you. Christian Pulisic is the best player on the U.S. national team right now. There's no next big thing. He's not the player of the future. He is the best player on this team right now. Clint Dempsey's getting older. He had a really bad game against Trinidad and Tobago. Not saying that Clint Dempsey is bad. He's still a very good player for the U.S., but he had a very poor game against Trinidad and Tobago. He's getting older. Josie Altidore is reliable at times, but goes missing. You can go through the line. Michael Bradley is, he takes a lot of heat for losing possession. He had a very good game against Mexico, but Bradley can be spotty at times. Christian Pulisic is the best player on this U.S. national team right now. I don't think he's the most important player, but he's the best player on this team right now at 18 years of age. And he is the biggest chance the U.S. has to having a global, I don't want to say superstar because he's not even close to the level of a superstar yet, but he's the closest the United States has come to potentially having a world-class player down the road. Borussia Dortmund has a fantastic player in Christian Pulisic right now, and his development has come on very, very well.
What's his personality like, and can he catch the American people and draw them into soccer, people that normally could care less about the sport?
Sure, and you know, he's not a flashy guy. He's not a, you know, like a Cristiano Ronaldo type personality. He's a very even keel. In fact, you know, if you were to compare it to another rising star right now, they're very similar. Aaron Judge is a very similar kind of player. You know, Joe Girardi's compared Aaron Judge to Derek Jeter in terms of his even keel and his ability to stay focused. Pulisic's the same way. He doesn't do a ton of interviews. He's not a flashy guy. He's not worried about his brand right now or anything like that. And I think that's really helped his development. And I think as he grows into the position with the U.S. national team, that kind of a thing, maybe gets a bit more of a starting role at Borussia Dortmund, we may see some of that come out. But for right now, he's a very even-keel, mature 18-year-old.
I still think he needs to, like, date a famous singer or something. That would help. He needs to date somebody famous. That would take it to the next level. That would help everybody in this situation. Like, is there an 18-year-old singer that we can set them up with?
Yeah, let's. I'm not the person to ask on the pop stars of the age, but I'm sure there's someone out there.
How much of an impact, though, can one guy make for team success? We're talking a lot about individual here, but how much of an impact in international soccer can one guy have on team success?
Well, I mean, you just look. Cristiano Ronaldo carried Portugal to the Euro Championship this past about a year ago, and so it's possible. You look at that Portugal team, and it's all Cristiano Ronaldo. Now, it's difficult to do. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo is one of the best two or three players in the world, and so it's difficult to do that. You look at Lionel Messi, maybe the best player in the world, has not been able to carry Argentina to an international title. He has not won a major trophy with Argentina in his career at the international level. So it's really, really difficult to do. Now, the competition in South America is a lot heavier than it is in North and Central America. So for Pulisic to maybe carry the United States to some titles, sure, the Gold Cup is coming up this summer, and Pulisic's on the roster. I'll bet he will be a featured player in that tournament, not just for the U.S., but for the whole tournament. So I think he certainly can carry the U.S. to some continental titles. For the World Cup, we'll see. That's going to depend a lot more on how the whole squad comes together.
Kyle, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Anytime.
Well, that is Kyle Bond, NBC Sports soccer writer. Extreme competitive kayaking is coming this Thursday to Saturday to the North Fork of the Payette River. The best big water paddlers will be there, and you can meet them at the Egyptian Theater in downtown Boise Thursday night. Details are at ktik.com. All brought to you by Toyota, one of the top sponsors of the North Fork. We got an update coming up. Fish, what do you have in it today?
Well, Eddie Lacy, once again, a richer man for just stepping on a scale, plus one Mountain West coach just out Lane Kiffin. That's coming up next in the Sports Update on Idaho Sports Talk.
The Ticket Sports Update.
Sponsored by the UI Tavern. $5 is all it takes for the hippest downtown Boise spot for happy hour. Meet your friends and bring your five to the UI Tavern Steak and Sea on 11th and Main. Well, Eddie Lacy is $55,000 richer, and all he had to do was stand on the scale. Lacy had several weigh-in clauses put in his contract when he signed with the Seattle Seahawks, and he met phase two, weighing in at under 250 pounds today, though he was not the only man who made some bank staying on his scale. The Dallas Cowboys guard Brian Bell earned $150,000 for weighing in at under 320 pounds.
If you're married, I would think it would be a very big incentive for your wife at home to make sure that you don't snack too much and you eat the right food.
Just keep yelling. How much was the money again?
for Lacey, 55,000.
Yeah. 55,000. So, Bob, like, what is the lowest weight you think you can get to for 55,000? Like I said, 175 pounds. I don't know.
That's what you weigh right now?
No. Could you get down to 175 pounds for $55,000?
Probably what, 40 pounds?
I wasn't going to put your weight in these streets, but
no, I don't care. I'd say 35, okay. 40 pounds.
Could you do what? We gotta do it.
I would try.
4 months, $55,000 on the line, 175 pounds. Can you do it? I'm not saying that we are going to accept this challenge, but could you, you think you could do it?
I don't know. I've never really tried to diet much. Maybe I should. Yeah, I would try for that price.
Okay. Do you think it would be something that's possible for you?
Maybe. I'm not giving a definite. Okay. Maybe.
Speaking of,
I'd have to have a personal trainer type person, I think, help me.
That's what the wife is for. Help you out.
No.
Help you.
Well, Bob said it's possible. Speaking of possible, it's possible that Titan Lakhdin could play for Hawaii. It's unlikely.
Who?
Titan Lakhdin.
He's from Hawaii. Get that name ready to in the broadcast?
Well, you may have a few years, Bob, because he was offered a scholarship by Hawaii. He's in the fifth grade.
Okay. What made them decide that this fifth grader was worthy?
I would assume, one, they get their name out. They get out Lane Kiffin, but... Other than that, from what I was able to gather on his Twitter account that he made just to say he has been offered a scholarship, he's from Hawaii, so I guess they're trying to keep the talent on the islands.
Okay.
That's about it. I did not get a chance to check out his highlight video. These kids look like they would come up to my kneecaps, so I don't know how impressed I can be by anything he does.
So give me the name again, Titan?
Titan Lakhdin.
Spell it.
Lacaden. He also has a brother, Jamie, plays for Nevada.
Okay, so he knows the way.
Yes.
Knows the way to become the D1 athlete. So maybe it's a good investment. I don't. This trend, has this ever worked out? Like, we've been doing this long enough to where, like, one of these kids
the one
that
of
was
a,
offered
the
a
very first one ended up becoming a quarterback. He was a kid who was offered at USC by Lane Kiffin. He became a quarterback at a junior college. He now plays receiver for West Virginia.
Can you imagine if the NCAA made a rule that if you offered somebody, they had to come if you wanted them? I mean, if they wanted to come?
Yeah, that would be
that
nuts.
That would cause people to not offer quickly, wouldn't it?
It'd be like,
wouldn't it? Oh, yeah. This kid all of a sudden isn't the athlete we thought he would be, what? Fifth grade be what, about 10 years later probably? 10, 12 years later? Yeah, that would change things in a hurry.
Put
college sports.
I'm waiting for the first one of these to actually work out. Offer a scholarship to a sixth grader, and the sixth grader actually turns into a high-level prospect and goes to that college of choice.
I don't think this kid... If this kid becomes good, do you think he's going to go to Hawaii?
He's Hawaiian?
Yes.
He's from Hawaii?
He's from Hawaii.
I'd say the odds might be decent.
We'll see. And speaking of more football news, Jeremy Maclin has picked a team. He has decided to sign with the Baltimore Ravens. And in addition, Vince Young not making his CFL debut anytime soon. Young playing in the Canadian Football League. Tore his hamstring, out 4 to 6 weeks for the Rough Riders.
That's a rough start for Mr. Young there. I get it. I mean, he's not had the smoothest career.
No.
His career is basically as bad as that joke.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, and maybe you're too young, Fish, but do you remember the time when there were two Rough Riders in the Canadian League?
I've heard about it.
There was Saskatchewan and Ottawa. Ottawa's now the Red Blacks. But one of them had Rough Riders as two words, and one of them had Rough Riders as one word.
All the difference. It's all you need.
Does this one spell one word or two?
Believe it's two.
Okay, then the one word was Ottawa then.
I would think Rough Riders sounds like two words. Too long for one word. Speaking of injuries, the Nationals bullpen, they've been struggling all year, and they had more struggles over the weekend. Their closer, Coda Glover, blew a save Saturday, and he's now been placed on the DL with a hurt back. Problem is, he didn't hurt it in the game. He hurt it before the game. Glover admitted after the game that he hurt his back showering. He went over to grab some soap, and he heard a pop. Didn't do anything about it, and he decided since he hadn't pitched in 3 days, he was going to go out there and try and pitch the ninth, saying, quote, "I didn't want to take a day off. I've already had three offs already." I tried to push the limits today, tried pitching through it, and he blew a 3-1 lead, didn't even make it out of the ninth inning. Nationals lose an 11-6-3.
Now, the Nationals are one of the best teams in the National League.
Yes.
With no closer, so to speak of.
No, probably worst
bullpens
in baseball.
I think it's a lock at the trade deadline that they pick up a closer. I think it's a lock.
Wait a minute. We're burying the lead here.
Got hurt showering? Yeah.
What is with these showers in pro sports that are so, like, painful? I feel like a lot of people get hurt in the shower. More people get hurt in the shower as professional athletes than non-professional athletes, and the ratio shouldn't be that way.
No.
The most athletic people shouldn't be the ones getting hurt in the shower, which lends me to think that these people aren't getting hurt in the shower, and they're just telling us they're getting hurt in the shower. They're getting hurt doing other
things. I mean, his story didn't really make sense. I reached for the soap, and I heard a pop in my back. You have a lot of issues if that's going on when you're showering.
Exactly. I was going to say, like, we need to start getting cameras in these showers.
No, we don't need cameras in these showers.
But that's not. We can't be putting cameras in these showers. But that's the one place you can say that the injury happened, because you know,
no one's going to know.
Nobody will ever know.
Unbelievable. And, well, we talked about the Patriots having their Super Bowl celebration over the weekend. The Falcons also having their own ceremony today, just not involving Super Bowl rings. The team announced Friday that former Falcons Michael Vick and Roddy White would be honored in a retirement news conference today. Falcons owner Arthur Blank said on the quarterback receiver duo that they were thrilled to be able to honor Roddy and Michael's wishes to retire as Falcons celebrate their careers. However, neither player will sign a one-day contract to retire with the team, Blank saying, "We do not need a contract in place to consider them as part of our family."
Agreed.
Round of applause.
Agreed. Yeah.
You spent so much time on this show yelling at the one-day contract.
I hate the one-day contract.
You should set Arthur Blank a letter.
I should. To me, the thing about contracts, who cares? I remember who you played for. Last is who you played for last, but there's the one team that you played for most. And to me, Michael Vick and Roddy White, when you think of who they played for, you're going to go with Falcons.
I'm surprised Michael Vick and Arthur Blank are able to function in the same room together. I feel like Arthur Blank just wouldn't even want anything to do with Michael Vick at this point, considering what he put the franchise through, lying to him to his face and everything. But I guess time heals all wounds. Now, on this note, you know, Vick and Roddy White honored together. I feel like White's career took off after Vick.
Yeah, like, they played two seasons together.
Exactly. It was like Matt Ryan really carried Roddy White to being the level of Roddy White. And isn't it fitting that Roddy White's retirement press conference is overshadowed by Michael Vick? His entire career seemed like he was overshadowed by other receivers.
So I'm really confused. Roddy White wanted a one-day contract, didn't sign one. He only ever played for the Falcons. He retired as a Falcon.
That's true.
Why did he need to I understand Vick. He went to the Eagles, he went to the Steelers. Roddy White never played for any other team. He spent 10 years in Atlanta and retired. What did he need a ceremony for? We already know he's a Falcon.
I think he wanted a one-day contract to actually prove he could still play. Like, I think he actually wanted a tryout. Like, you know what? I can still do this.
I remember Roddy White most for tweeting out on draft day that the Falcons made a terrible decision to trade for Julio Jones.
Oh, he did that?
Yep. He said, "Why would we trade 5 picks for a receiver when we already got one?"
He should be smarter than that. He should know that there's more than one receiver that plays at once.
I think he saw the writing on the wall when they picked a guy at number 4 to take his job.
I think that Julio Jones did more good than harm for Roddy White. Extended his career a little bit.
That's all I remember Roddy White for, is being very upset the Falcons drafted a receiver at 4.
Lack of foresight from 84.
Enjoy Idaho's only authentic Greek gyro made with all natural, traditionally marinated, hand-stacked meats and fresh local ingredients at Meraki Greek Street Food. It's located in Bodo on 8th between Front and Myrtle. We got quick picks up next. Do either one of us have the guts to pick the Cavs tonight? We'll find out next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
It's time to consult the Magic 8-Ball. Open up a fortune cookie, or maybe even flip a coin.
I get him into the future.
However they do it, it's time for some quick picks and predictions with Bob and Chris.
And sponsored by Pro-Am Sports, your full-service pro shop and bowling specialist with high-quality bowling balls, bags, shoes, and accessories located right inside Westie's Garden Lanes in Garden City. You guys both went 2-1 over the weekend, mainly because you guys picked the same 3 things. You both had Golden State winning Game 4, game being decided by more than 10 or less. Double-digit win for the Cavs or the Warriors, and you both had the Penguins winning. So we'll let Bob go first since he is the reigning week champion. So, Bob, we'll start with the obvious. Who you got winning Game 5 tonight, the Cavaliers or the Warriors?
I'm going to speak for myself in this one. I'm glad you didn't say that you had to get the winner and who was going to win by more than 10, because I was with Golden State on Friday night. I think, Chris, are you concurring? We both thought it was going to be a Golden State win by 10, but you phrased it. Was the game going to be 10? And
game.
We both said yes. So I'm going with Golden State. I think the pressure's on them tonight. You say why they're up 3-1. Cleveland's got the backs against the wall, but people are expecting Golden State to win at this point. I believe that if Golden State does not win tonight, Cleveland will be back in the series at 3-2, heading back to Cleveland. So I think Golden State wants to shut the door here. I think they'll play better at home. They do have Draymond Green, something they didn't have last year in Game 5. I think Golden State gets the gentleman's sweep.
Let me put your feet to the fire here, because you keep talking about this so-called pressure, how the pressure is on Golden State. If the Warriors lose this game, will the Cavs win the series?
No, but I think it'll go 7.
Okay. So it would be a Game 7 win. You were picking against LeBron James in the Game 7. Then we learned the lesson.
I wanted to make me right. I said Golden State 7 from the start. So.
I did say Cavs in 6. I'm going to go with the Warriors as well. Now, the Cavs can give it to LeBron, let him post up, and maybe Kyle Korver gets hot or something like that. But it took 49 points in the first half, or first quarter, 86 points at halftime, 24 three-pointers, an NBA Finals record. And I still, with 6 minutes left to go in the game, thought the Warriors were going to win. Like, that's how much it was still, like, to be up in the air with about 6 minutes left. It was about 4. It was like, all right, finally, I think the Cavaliers are going to get this thing done. It took a near-perfect game for the Cavs to win 1. I don't think they're going to play perfect in Golden State. Celebration in Oakland tonight.
Well, staying in Oakland, will there, the pick number 2, will there be 1 triple-double tonight in Game 5? There have been 3 so far in the 4 games in the finals. LeBron twice, Curry once, and LeBron averaging a triple-double, which has never been done in the finals. So, Chris Lewis, will we see 1, exactly 1, in case 2 guys somehow go crazy, will we see exactly 1 triple-double tonight in Game 5?
You got to think, in this series, you have 3 people who have had a triple-double in the finals before. LeBron, Draymond, and Steph. I don't believe Durant ever did in his first trip there. I'm going to say no. I'm going to think nobody gets a triple-double. I actually think this pace will be a little bit slower than what it has been a good chunk, especially in games 1 and 2. Slower the pace, the less stats there are to accumulate, so it's harder to get a triple-double. LeBron will be close, because if he plays basketball for 45 minutes, he gets close. He'll get over the 10. He'll likely get close to 10 rebounds or probably close to 10 assists, too. So he'll be close. I think Draymond might be close to getting one in this game, too, but I don't think anybody will.
Bob?
I concur. I'm going to go with nobody. It's tough to get a triple-double. I know there have been 3 already in the series. I don't know. I just don't think that I think we're going to have a little lower-scoring game tonight, so I think there'll be less stats to go around.
And we'll go to baseball for the 3rd pick. Masahiro Tanaka on the mound tonight for the Yankees. I was watching some Yankees games over the weekend. Brian Cashman said he doesn't believe the Yankees are going to trade for an ace pitcher at the deadline because they have one in Tanaka. The only problem, he hasn't won in over a month. His last win was May 8th, and he's given up 5 or more runs in 4 of his last 5 outings. He's playing the Angels tonight. Bob, will Masahiro Tanaka get the win tonight and win for the first time in over a month?
Yankees will trade for a starting pitcher. I disagree with Cashman. He's blowing smoke. Tanaka's given up 27 runs in his last 22 and a third innings, including 11 home runs in that time frame. Joe Girardi says he thinks that Tanaka has fixed some mechanics, that he was opening his shoulder early. I am going to go with Tanaka getting the win against the Angels and reversing what has been an awful month plus.
Chris?
Tanaka, come on. In the words of Patman Jones, my man's been garbage lately. I wonder if we still got that job somewhere buried within
it's
the
buried
depths.
Buried very, very deep right now.
Within the depths of that board. The Patman Jones garbage quote. That's what Tanaka's been. His ERA, he's given up the most earned runs in the American League. He hasn't been any good. Why do I think it's going to turn around? What, mechanics? You could look at, if it was just a mechanical issue, it would have been saw before he gave up the most amount of runs in the American League. Come on, I know the Yankees' offense is good, but I have no confidence in Tanaka.
Guys are tied at 2-1, one game different apiece. You miss any of the picks, you can check them out on the KTIK Twitter page.
Extreme competitive kayaking is coming this Thursday to Saturday to the North Fork of the Payette River. The best big water paddlers will be there, and you can meet them at the Egyptian Theater in downtown Boise Thursday night. Details available at KTIK.com, and it's all brought to you by Toyota, one of the top sponsors of the North Fork. Jeff Cave's in studio. He and Mike Prater will be taking over in a matter of minutes. Jeff, what do you guys have on for a Monday?
Yeah, we've got some interesting news really coming from the State Board of Education on alcohol policies and how this may be an opportunity for Boise State coming up this fall, as well as Idaho and Idaho State. The disturbing story of the pitcher from the Oregon State who DQ'd himself, and whether he'll go in the Major League Baseball draft today. Well, a lot of people have been talking about that all weekend. The horrific images, really, of John Patrick. And, you know, you are who you with. I don't know, Bob. I've never seen photos of you bragging about local strip establishments putting your name up in lights and claiming that they're a they have a relationship with you. But I would assume that that wouldn't work for you morally.
No, it would not.
I am a bit concerned because it's blowing up on this on the Twitter streets. You got this picture that we're listening, JP. So what's the I'm missing the background. What's JP out here doing?
Well, it concerns a lot of people that somebody would be as addicted as he is. And make these trips during the day to brag about his association with this establishment. So we'll let him explain himself. We're very concerned about it. I'm sure there's a lot of people on corporate that are very surprised at this behavior being as public as it is and promoting it. So it could be his last program for a while. Hopefully there's a suspension to get him right. I mean, Tiger Woods
Pac-Man
has had sex addiction therapy, plus now he'll have pain pill medication therapy. So I don't know what JP's hooked on.
Wow.
It's the Pac-Man Jones of the station. I've been trying to tell you. All he's missing is the dreadlocks. He's going to be Pac-Man Jones up in here. All addicted to these strip clubs. Come on, man.
Looking forward to that, Jeff. And again, down to the last tonight, NBA, Chris, are we talking about the championship tomorrow? You and I both think yes.
Yeah, somebody's going to get that trophy. And Kevin Durant going to be the finals MVP, or we're going to start the jokes, which might be the better result, right? Start the 3-1 jokes, because they'll be coming, except this would be 3-0. Going back to Cleveland would be so fun. So
I think it would be more unbelievable than last year.
Yeah, 3-0 is more unbelievable than 3-1.
Yeah. We'll be back tomorrow at 1. Caves, Prater, JP around the corner as Idaho Sports Talk continues from 3 to 6. That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.